Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, November 27th. Analysis shows super majors lag independence in Permian Basin. Experts, giants would need to boost drilling to meet pace, by Mella McEwen. Two of the world's super major oil and gas producers tout their leadership in the Permian Basin and how the region is the future of their upstream growth. But a new analysis by the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis finds independent operators actually dominate ExxonMobil and Chevron in Permian production, and the two super majors are not likely to overtake independents at their current pace. Our point of the report is that within the Permian, both Chevron and ExxonMobil are not hitting it out of the park with their Permian wells. Trey Cowan, oil and gas industry analyst with IEEFA, told the Reporter Telegram by email, "It is a question of optics and transparency. Both could use some tweaking, in our opinion." He said IEEFA's data suggests that between 2018 and 2020, neither Chevron nor ExxonMobil brought into production new wells than Pioneer Natural Resources in the Permian Basin or Occidental Petroleum in the Delaware Basin. It's hard to be the leader in daily production for a region if your new well activity levels are not leading, he observed. Cowan also noted that Chevron reported in its supplement to its annual report last year that it had the premier position for acreage in the Permian with its acquisition of Noble Energy in October 2020, which gave it 92,000 continuous and adjacent acres in Reeves County that produced an average 59,000 barrels per day of oil equivalent in 2020. But we know Occidental had more Permian acreage in 2020, he said. To be fair, he added, Chevron stated earlier in its supplement that it has one of the largest net acreage positions. So, Cowan said, even though they're acknowledging that they are not the leader by this metric, they just confused the issue later with their wording. ExxonMobil, he said, reported the most activity for their subsidiary XTO Energy in the Permian, but that is state data from 2019 when they were using the most rigs. When we look at new wells brought into production as the activity metric, ExxonMobil ranks fifth with 825 newly Permian-producing wells between 2018 and 2020. Pioneer, earlier this year, overtook Occidental to become the largest Permian Basin producer, Cowan said, and Big Oil's average productivity per well lags far behind EOG resources in the Delaware Basin. Both Chevron and ExxonMobil would have to significantly increase their drilling and completion activity to meet the pace of the leading independents, Cowan said, something he doesn't see in the near future. From their recent comments, it appears that both are satisfied with their respective results in the Permian, and both are stepping up activity for drilling and completions heading into next year. But this is because, he said, higher oil prices of late have given all the operators, not just Chevron and ExxonMobil, more cash to work with and spread around. Oil prices plunged more than $10. Fueled by new COVID variant, crash may lead OPEC to reconsider policy, by Julia Fanzaris and Alex Longley, Bloomberg. Oil prices suffered one of the largest ever one-day plunges, crashing more than 11% on Black Friday as a new coronavirus strain sparked fears that renewed lockdowns will hurt global demand. The crash, the seventh largest ever for Brent crude, the global oil benchmark, may prompt the OPEC Plus cartel to reconsider its policy when it meets next week with the group increasingly leaning toward pausing its output hikes. West Texas Intermediate for January fell $10.24, or 13.1%, from Wednesday's close to settle at $68.15 a barrel in New York. The decline was the largest since April 2020. The sell-off was amplified by low liquidity on a festive day in the U.S., the breach of several technical supports and Wall Street banks rushing to dump oil futures to protect themselves against positions in the options market. The development apparently wrong-footed many in the oil market who had been comforted by low inventory levels and demand that had rebounded to 2019 levels, said Rebecca Babin, senior energy trader at CIBC Private Wealth Management. It was a lack of downside that had us continuing to think nothing bad could happen, she said. No one was thinking we could get a variant that we're not familiar with, and it could have meaningful impact. The price drop capped a dramatic week for the oil market, which started when U.S. President Joe Biden challenged OPEC Plus by tapping the country's strategic petroleum reserve in an effort to bring gasoline prices down. China, India, Japan, and South Korea all joined the American effort. Oil traders and analysts were divided about whether the flash crash was an excessive reaction to the COVID news. Damian Corvallon, oil analyst at Goldman Sachs in New York, called the drop an excessive repricing and ventured OPEC Plus will respond, pausing its production increases by 3 months. Friday's oil sell-off was likely exacerbated by a lack of trading activity during the U.S. holiday period, coming a day after Thanksgiving and as the New York market closed early. It's a sign the market got carried away from itself and that we still remain very vulnerable to COVID-19, said John Kilduff, founding partner at Again Capital, LLC. Aside from the headline prices, crude traders also watched several other notable shifts in the market. WTI crude futures closed below its 200-day and 100-day moving averages, signs of technical weakness. The extreme pressure on the U.S. benchmark meant its discount to Brent expanded, reaching the widest since May 2020. The picture wasn't much brighter in oil product markets. The part of the oil complex most directly affected by end-user demand. Diesel plunged, particularly in Asia, as the market began to price in a potential renewed hit to economic growth. This is a huge overreaction in terms of the market, Amrita Sen, chief oil analyst at consultant Energy Aspects Limited, said in a Bloomberg television interview. This is the market pricing in the worst possible scenarios. Midland Festival celebrates 30 years. Master storytellers aim to inspire MISD students with tales. The 30th Annual Midland Storytelling Festival will take place December 2nd through the 4th. The festival, which started in 1992 under the auspices of the Midland Independent School District, will feature virtual and in-person performances from 7 master storytellers, according to a news release. The lineup includes Donald Davis of Ocracoke, North Carolina. Davis has been present for all 30 years of the festival. Other storytellers include Bill Lepp of Charleston, West Virginia, Charlotte Blake Alston of Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, Laura Pershin Rayner of Ann Arbor, Michigan, Antonio Roca of Gray, Maine, Willie Claflin of San Francisco, and Barbara McBride-Smith of Jonesboro, Tennessee. Visiting performers will provide programs for students throughout the Midland community on Education Connection Day, December 3rd. This includes Midland's private and charter schools, Greenwood ISD, Bynum School, and homeschool students who can attend programs at the Centennial Branch of the Midland County Library. There will also be a special program provided for Manor Park Retirement Community. The goal is to share the uplifting inspiration of stories told in the oral tradition with as many people as possible, said Sue Roseberry, executive director for the festival. It is entertainment for everyone. Roseberry reminded the Midland community that the public is invited to come out December 4th for performances at 10 a.m., 11:15 a.m., and 7 p.m. at Bush Convention Center. Admission is free. In addition, there will be a live broadcast on Basin PBS for Family Fun Night from 7 to 9 p.m. on December 3rd. Festivities will be available for viewing on livestream.com through the remainder of the year. For additional information, go to www.MidlandStorytellingFestival.org or call 432-685-3876. Latest county housing report shows typical October decline by Stuart Doreen. It was a typical October housing market inside Midland County, according to the Texas A&M Real Estate Center. The total dollar volume of homes sold topped $76 million, which was nearly a repeat performance for every October, going back to 2018. The center reported $77.67 million in October 2020, $77.875 million in October 2019, and $78.632 million in October 2018. The center also reported that during each of the last four Octobers, the median price of a home sold also fell from the previous month. This year, that median price dropped from $315,000 in September to $302,750 in October. Still, the median price in October 2021 was the highest of any October in Midland County, according to the center. Midland County again posted the highest median price for a home sold of any West Texas county. Behind Midland County was Ector, $245,000, Tom Green, $235,000, Randall, $232,000, Lubbock, $222,750, Taylor, $222,000, and El Paso, $200,000. Interestingly, the average price of a home sold fell by more than $45,000 from September, $379,450, to October, $333,840. It was the largest month-over-month drop going back to 2017. Coincidentally, the $50,000-plus drop happened that year between September and October. Still, the housing hot streak inside Midland County continued. The A&M Real Estate Center reported that October was the 38th straight month that the average price for a home sold topped $300,000 in Midland County. The median price for a home sold also has not dropped below $280,000 for 38 months. Other highlights of the report included: the 761 homes on the market were the most since January, 768. The months of inventory also increased to 3.1. October marked the eighth straight month that more than 200 homes were sold, 228. Airline passengers return to Midland International, by Stuart Doreen. If the number of people flying out of Midland International is any indication, then Midland is much closer to 2018 than it is 2020. The City of Midland reported a rebound at Midland International accelerated in October. The 50,228 passengers flying out of Midland on either Southwest Airlines, American Eagle, or United was the third most for an October in the last 10 years, trailing only the 58,884 in October 2019 and the 51,217 in October 2018. The rapid improvement also can be seen comparing boardings from September and October. The September report showed boardings reaching 90.6% of the total from 2018. In October, the total was 98.1% of the numbers of boardings from October 2018. The 71.6% improvement year over year was predictable. The number of seats available on the three airlines at Midland International jumped 66%, and the commercial landings increased 50.2%. The increased activity also meant net parking revenues increased 135.2% year over year to $459,929, a number higher than October 2018, $412,974, and October 2019, $398,327. Of the three airlines, Southwest captured 43.2% of the passengers flying out of Midland International. American Eagle was second with 28.8% of the passengers. Midland Job Growth Among Top 10 in U.S. by Stuart Doreen. The Midland Metropolitan Statistical Area ranked among the top 10 in the nation during the month of September for the largest change in the employees on non-farm payrolls, not seasonally adjusted, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Midland's year-over-year growth in September was 7.8%, which was good enough for seventh overall, according to the BLS. Midland's percentage also was the highest in Texas in September. Austin, Round Rock, and Tyler tied for second at 7.4%. In August, the percentage was 6.5%. The number of employees in the Midland MSA increased from 91,500 to 98,600. Obituaries and death notices from the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Saturday. Bernardina Hernandez, Kiro, age 94, went to be with our Lord on Tuesday, November 23rd. Bernardina was born in Stanton. Bernardina is preceded in death by her parents, Andres and Carmen Martinez, and husband Frank Hernandez. She is survived by her daughters Yolanda Isom, Olga Hernandez, and Viola Buchanan. She is also survived by her son Frank Hernandez, Jr. Due to COVID and to protect our family and yours, no rosary will be given and the viewing will be limited to immediate family only. The funeral mass will be celebrated at St. Stephen's Catholic Church on Tuesday, November 30th at 10 a.m. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Cemetery. Online condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.LlewellynGarciaPipkinFH.com. Betsy Elaine Vest, 69, of Midland, passed away on Monday, November 22nd. Betsy was born in Fort Ord, California, on February 8, 1952. She is preceded in death by her father, W.F. Lagow, her mother, Mary Lagow, brother Reginald Reggie Lagow, and her grandparents. Betsy is survived by her husband, Jerry Vest, her sister, Carol Hogsveen, and spouse, Dag, and many nieces, nephews, family, and friends. A visitation for Betsy will be held Monday, November 29th, from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home in Midland. A funeral service will occur Tuesday, November 30th at 11 a.m. at Ellis Funeral Home in Midland. A reception will occur Tuesday, November 30th from 11:45 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. at Ellis Funeral Home. A committal service will occur Tuesday, November 30th at 1 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Midland. Billy Othell Harris, 88, went to be with our Lord on November 22nd. Papa, as he was known to his loving family, was born on December 3rd, 1932, in Trent, Texas, to Ora Beatrice Vessel and Robert Judson Harris. He is preceded in death by his parents and his two brothers, J.H. Harris and Bobby Joe Harris. He leaves a legacy of family to cherish his memory, his wife Wanda, daughter Kathy Lynn West, and husband Denzel, his grandsons, and 11 great-grandchildren. Funeral service will be held on Monday, November 29th at 1 p.m. at First United Methodist Church. Private family burial will be held at Rest Haven Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, the family asks for a memorial donation to Hospice of Midland at 911 West Texas Avenue, Midland, Texas, 79701, or First United Methodist Church, Midland, at 300 North Main Street, Midland, Texas, 79701. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Carolyn Jean Glanton Wood, age 87, of Midland, passed away Wednesday, November 24th. A family service will be held in Barstow, Texas, at a later date. Carolyn Wood was born April 25, 1934, in Hobbs, New Mexico, to Beatrice Dinwiddie Glanton and Fred Glanton. Carolyn is survived by her husband of 69 years, Sam Wood, daughters Karen Wood Jones and husband Tom of Mobetee, Texas, and Melanie Wood Burkett and husband Craig of Midland. She's also survived by granddaughters and grandson and 6 great-grandchildren. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to St. Luke's Methodist Church in Midland or a charity of your choice. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Joseph Kramer, born October 26, 1946, and passed away peacefully at his home November 13, 2021, surrounded by his family. Preceded in death by his parents Earl J. Kramer and Willetta Haston Kramer, brothers Pat Kramer, William Kramer, and James Kramer. Survived by his children Tracy Carter and husband Eric, Joseph Kramer, Patricia Kramer and husband Dennis, Julie McKim and husband Noel McKim, and grandchildren. Burial will take place November 30th at 1:30 p.m. in Fort Stanton, New Mexico, at the Fort Stanton States Veterans Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to Hope Hospice of New Braunfels, 611 North Walnut, or Wounded Warriors Project, 12672 Silicon Drive, Suite 105, San Antonio, Texas, 78249. Shiloh Richardson passed away on November 16, 2021. His family and friends will celebrate his life Saturday, the 27th, at Odessa Country Club. Will Holmes, 14, of Midland, passed away on Monday, November 22nd, in Bandera County, Texas. Graveside services were held November 29th at Fairview Cemetery, followed by a celebration of Will's life at Christ Church Anglican. Will was born on November 27, 2006, to Mary Jane and Bill Holmes in Midland. Will is survived by his parents, sisters Mary Claire and Beth Ann Holmes of Midland, grandparents Betty Ray and Paul Davis of Midland, grandmother Barbara Holmes of Lufkin. Will is preceded in death by his big sister Louisa, his grandfather Will S. Holmes. In lieu of flowers, the Holmes family gratefully requests that memorials be donated to the Will Holmes Bible Bank or the Will Holmes Scholarship Fund, or any charity of your choice. To donate to the Will Holmes Bible Bank within the Vietnamese Bible, Inc., please mail checks to P.O. Box 61, Midland, Texas, 79702. To donate to the Will Holmes Scholarship Fund, please mail checks to Shelton School at 17301 Preston Road, Dallas, Texas, or online at shelton.org using the link listed on the website. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Adelina Cortez, 73, of Midland, passed away on Tuesday, November 23rd. Viewing will be Tuesday, November 30th, from 12 to 9 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Chapel. Funeral service is set for Wednesday, December 1st at 2 p.m. at La Roca, the Rock Church. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. She is survived by her husband, Antonio Tony Cortez, two sons, Jose Luis Tucker and David Anthony Cortez, two daughters, Cece Gordon and Lupe Lopez, one brother, Max Ortiz, and five sisters, Janie Navarro, Gloria Murillo, Yolanda Munoz, Esperanza Munoz, and Connie Corrales. Floyd Baba Brooks, 79, of Midland, passed away on Saturday, November 13th. Funeral service was held Saturday at Mount Rose Baptist Church. Burial followed at Rest Haven North Cemetery. He leaves to cherish his memory his son Kyle Brooks, his daughter Holly Nicole Brooks Jackson, brother David Brooks, three sisters Rose Rowles, Vera Gilmore, and Iris Jean Simmons, and three grandchildren. Fred Bost, 95, of Midland, passed away on Thursday, November 25th. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, November 30th, at the First Baptist Church Chapel. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Guillermo V. Rios, of Midland, passed away on Monday, November 22nd. Viewing was held Saturday, November 27th. Funeral Mass will be Monday, November 29th at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Cemetery. He is survived by his children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. John Richard Slauson, 84, of Midland, passed away on Thursday, November 25th. A visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Friday, December 3rd, at the Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home in Midland. A memorial service will take place at 10 a.m. Saturday, December 4th, at the Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel, with interment to follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Nathan Paul Hale, 59, of Midland, passed away on Friday, November 19th. A celebration of life will be Saturday, December 4th at 11:30 a.m. at Valley View Baptist Church. Arrangements were made with Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. He is survived by a wife, Sheila Hale, son, William Hale, daughter, Jolene Rodriguez, one brother, Jimmy Michael Hale, one sister, Vera Karen Childers, and four grandchildren. Sidney Aldridge, 80, of Midland, passed away on November 21st. Family services will be held at a later date. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Odessa American for Saturday, November 27th. Parade of Lights Set to Return by Michael Bauer. After last year's hiatus due to the pandemic, the Odessa Parade of Lights will make its return this year. The event will start at 6:30 p.m. December 4th at 23rd Street on Andrews Highway and travel south on Andrews Highway, where it will turn west on 3rd Street in the Medical Center Hospital parking lot for destaging. Event coordinator at Downtown Odessa, Inc., Alexa Moulakis, says there's a lot of excitement to have the parade back this year after having to miss it last year due to COVID protocols. Everything last year was just so off and nothing felt right, Moulakis said. This year, we're finally getting back into the swing of things. We're really going to celebrate the holidays like we're used to doing out here. A big part of that has been the Parade of Lights. Getting to do that and seeing the excitement that people have, and we're super excited to do this year after not being able to do it last year. This year, event organizers are hopeful of having an even bigger parade than the last one in 2019. So every year that we've had the parade for the past 5 or 6 years, minus last year, we've seen an increased participation both in the number of organizations and the number of vehicles, and we're on pace to surpass the number that we had in 2019, Moulakis said. Any time that we're able to do that is great. We love being able to provide an opportunity for the community to come out and see all the hard work that people put into their floats and really bring in the holiday cheers. The bigger, the better. We love seeing all the creativity. We love seeing all that happiness, especially from all the kids when they get to see all the lights and all the decorations and characters and all of that. Moulakis said that in previous years, the parade has had over 70 organizations, many of which have multiple vehicles and floats. There have been upwards of 120 to 130 vehicles and floats in the past. We're optimistic that we're going to surpass that number, Moulakis said. This year, Moulakis is estimating that there will be 130 to 140 vehicles. Odessa City Manager Michael Marrero is also optimistic that they will see a large number of participants. That's still yet to be seen because we recently opened the registration, so we're hopeful that many folks take advantage and many organizations will take part in the parade, Marrero said. That's always exciting to see new floats for the year. Oftentimes, you'll have the same groups, but they mix it up, so it's always exciting to see what's new this year. Music lovers will also be in luck once again this year, as all the marching bands from around Ector County Independent School District perform, including the middle schools and the high schools. We actually partner with ECISD, Moulakis said. You're going to see everyone out there. They're all going to be out there. We bookcase the middle school bands in between two high school bands, OHS and Permian, switch back and forth to see who starts off the parade and who gets to end the parade. We'll continue that tradition this year. Moulakis says that Compass Academy's marching band is expected to take part, and in the past, they've had the marching band from UTPB as well. The lineup for the parade begins at Odessa College. They're very great partners, Moulakis said of Odessa College. One of the things that Moulakis says makes the Parade of Lights such a crowd pleaser is that there's no one set theme. Other places do like a themed Christmas parade, but sometimes there's only so much you can do, Moulakis said. Here, we really like to see people's creativity. So we give some basic guidelines and basic rules to all participants. Some of the rules are that all floats need to have working Christmas lights and no depiction of Santa. The city actually does the Santa float, Moulakis said. He's the last thing in the parade. Those are the only rules. Other than that, we let people use their creativity. It's really amazing, and we get a lot of compliments on how people can take Christmas and the holidays in so many different directions. Registration goes on until 6 p.m. December 4th. However, after noon on December 1st, there will be a late fee of $25 added. We really suggest people get registered before December 1st to avoid that late fee, Moulakis said. The price to register depends on the entry division. For commercial businesses, it's $100, Moulakis said. If they want to enter the mayor's awards, that's an additional $50. If they are a community organization, that's $75. And if they are an individual or family, it's $50. Even individuals can decorate their vehicles and can join, or if people want to bring their horses into the parade, they can do that as well. There will be one event that will be new before this year's parade. A Market Street will take place on Texas Avenue the day of the event, located one block off the parade, going from 3rd Street to 5th. The Market Street will be a way for spectators to come early and have something to do before the parade starts. We'll have vendors and food trucks and bouncing houses, Moulakis said, so that when people go out, they can leave their chairs or their blankets or whatever they want to mark their space, and they'll have something to do to keep them occupied before the parade. After the parade, we're going to have Santa out there for activities. Marrero says they want people to have fun, but also clean up after themselves and be mindful of the pandemic that is still going on. "We want everyone to come out and have a great time," Marrero said. But we also want people to remember that COVID is still a concern in this community. We want them to enjoy themselves, but we also want them to help us in terms of making sure they take any trash back with them. So it makes it easier for our street cleaning folks so they can come back and not have a large amount of debris to deal with. Black Magic takes stage in December. Permian High School's Black Magic Christmas show returns December 10th to First Baptist Church, 709 North Lee Avenue. The show starts at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are $15 for reserved seats and $8 for children and students. You can purchase tickets at www.permianchoir.com. Head Choir Director Kenneth Seeloff said work on the show started in October. "Everyone is happy to be getting closer to what we used to have in terms of what was quote-unquote normal. Last year, we avoided certain songs because we didn't want the dancing to get too close. But this year, we felt comfortable to go ahead and do those songs, and they love the songs," Seeloff said. "They're all working really hard, and they're really investing themselves in the process." Caitlin Jackson, a 17-year-old senior who is playing keyboards in the show, is in her second year in Black Magic. "It's going to be a very family-friendly show," Jackson said. "There's going to be a lot of new songs that we don't usually do. It's going to be at First Baptist, which is always a really great venue. There's going to be a great light show that comes with it." Jackson added that the vocalists and band members are talented and work hard to learn all the songs. "It's going to be high energy. It's going to be a Christmas show, and it's going to be really exciting," she added. Jackson said there was a show last year, but due to COVID, couldn't have as many people. "And when you don't have as many people in the crowd, it's less high energy. You don't get as much a reactive experience for the audience, which affects performance sometimes. So better turnout, I think, will be a better experience for everyone. It's more of a community experience," she added. Being a senior, this will be Jackson's last Christmas show with Black Magic, and she loves Christmas music. "It's really bittersweet," Jackson said. She added that the group is like a family. "We treat each other like we're family, so it makes me want to make the show the best it can be," Jackson said. Thomas Bell, an 18-year-old senior, is a sound technician, also in his second year with the group. He is also involved in Cantorai. Bell said he monitors the sound for the vocalists, the band, and skits. "It seems nerve-wracking, but when you get the gist of it, it's very simple. And with sound, you just have to really open your ears with everything," Bell said. On a show week, Bell said he and his fellow sound technician, Easton Easley, set up all the instruments, the soundboard, microphones, batters, and all the headsets for the vocalists. "And then later that day, when we're going through microphone checks, we would make sure that no one's sticking out and no one's too low. We're just constantly checking before the show to make sure that nothing's gone wrong," Bell said. He added that he thinks the show will run smoother than last year because they have gotten a couple of upgrades in the soundboard. "I also feel like it won't be as hard this year to move everything due to last year having a lot of COVID. So I think it'll be a lot more than what we were used to last year. I feel like we'll have a much wider range of doing things," he added. Like Jackson, Bell said he's excited about the Christmas show. He said this won't be the last time he watches a show or is involved in one. "But it makes me happy knowing that I'm going into this Christmas show working with a younger sound guy, Easton, and showing him the ways of doing sound because I see his work and I see how determined he is. And I always listen to all of his ideas that he's pitching, and I want him to see him grow more in the future," Bell said. Vocalist Garrett Watkins is an 18-year-old senior in his third year with Black Magic. His mother, Kim, painted panels that will be part of his song, What Child Is This? I'm super excited for this year, Watkins said. We have a really good group, and we have a really young group, too. I thought it'd be really cool to see how they go from never being on stage to getting on stage, and I think it'll be really cool with seeing how they do. He said having his mom create the panels for his song was really cool. We're doing panels with baby Jesus, and then we're going to have Mary and Joseph, and then we'll have the three wise men, and then the three gifts that they bring. And they'll come out during my song at certain parts, so I have something to kind of help bring across the message, Watkins said. He said his mom has been super involved in everything he does. She always likes to do that kind of stuff, Watkins said. Last year, she helped him choreograph the dance he did for his song. He added that the show is going to be super emotional because it's his last Christmas performance and he missed out last year. Watkins also is looking forward to having a larger audience. I think it will be a lot more fun because last year we couldn't sell as many tickets, so we had to do two different shows. Doing one, I'm hoping that we can fill the entire house, and that'll be something that we haven't gotten to do yet. So it'll be really cool, he added. MCHS and Ace Hardware team up for annual fundraiser by Michael Bauer. For 30 years now, local Ace Hardware stores across the Permian Basin have partnered up with Medical Center Health System to raise money for the annual Children's Miracle Network Hospital's Holiday Roundup for Kids campaign. The annual fundraiser returns this year, with the campaign having begun Friday and ending on December 24th. During the month-long fundraiser, money is raised through a register campaign where customers can round up their purchase to the nearest dollar when they check out. Customers can round up their purchases to the nearest dollar, or they can donate more if they wish, Children's Miracle Network Program Director Haley Howey said. 100% of funds raised at the Ace Hardware stores go directly to benefit the sick and injured kids treated at Medical Center Health System. Funds are used to pay for equipment, research, supplies, charitable care, and a variety of other needs the NICU and pediatric units have. Those funds go to everything from equipment to help care for the kids and babies and provide care for the families like hotel stays, gas, even buying them supplies. Howie said, all of the funds that people donate at Ace Hardware stays local to help kids here. In the Permian Basin, Ace Hardware employees and customers have raised more than $260,000 for Medical Center Health System since 1991. On a national level, Ace Hardware has raised more than $130 million for Children's Miracle Network hospitals in the United States and Canada. Howie is hopeful that they can raise even more in 2021, with this year's goal of $80,000. We've been slowly increasing that over the years, Howie said. It's been steady growth with this campaign. Now more than ever, customers are finding out that it's an easy way to give and it's convenient. It adds up pretty quickly. Those little pennies add up more quickly than you realize. Every little bit helps. But even if you can't give more than a few cents, it still adds up to make a big difference for these kids. Part of the reason for the fundraiser's success has been in part the increasing awareness and social media, which has made it easier to get the word out every year. I think there's been more of an awareness of what Roundup actually is, Howie said. I think it's become more mainstream giving, so I think we're seeing more of a trend that way. But it's more convenient for people to give through these retailers. It's convenient and easy, and when you're already shopping at Ace Hardware, why not just round up your purchase to the nearest dollar? Redistricting Joint Task Force to meet. A meeting of the Ector County Redistricting Joint Task Force Committee, a committee formed pursuant to an interlocal agreement between the Ector County Independent School District, the Ector County Hospital District, Odessa Junior College District, Ector County, and the City of Odessa will be held at 2 p.m. December 1st in Conference Room AB on the third floor of the ECISD Administration Building, 802 North Sam Houston Avenue. Some of the items on the agenda include election of a chairperson, vice chairperson, and secretary for the Joint Task Force Committee, overview of redistricting law and process, hear redistricting services proposal from Bickerstaff Law Firm, questions and discussion, develop general timeline for work product, scheduled next meeting or meetings of the redistricting committee. Death notices from the Odessa American for Saturday. Frank Lee Miller, 63, of Gardendale, died Thursday, November 18th in Gardendale. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. November 29th at Sunset Memorial Funeral Home. Burial will follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Pastor Wade Welch is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Ruth Ariano Enriquez, 44, of Odessa, died Sunday, November 21st in Corpus Christi. Funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. Monday, November 29th, at Acres West 24-Hour Chapel. Burial to follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Hello, this is Cindy, reading from the Odessa American for Sunday, November 28th. Wildcatters drove oil development. Pioneers Never Give Up Attitude cited in Review of History by Bob Campbell. In the oil field's present-day context of wrenching anxiety over the policies of the Biden administration, historians find the example of the old-time West Texas wildcatters inspiring because the industry's present day is founded on their indomitable spirit. Historians Pat McDaniel and Kathy Shannon say that with little but determination and rudimentary technology, the wildcatters sometimes hit 10 dry holes in a row before finally making the big strike. Those days of the wildcatters from west of Abilene made this part of the world significant in the oil and gas industry, said McDaniel, director of the Haley Memorial Library and J. Evetts Haley History Center in Midland. C.T. McLaughlin brought in numerous wells on his Diamond M. Ranch at Snyder, and George H.W. Bush, Earl Craig, Toby Hilliard, Pomeroy Smith, and Ed Lead brought the Eastern cultural influence in the early 1960s. O.C. Kip Harper was one of the first oil scouts who literally camped out while studying surface geology. Clayton Williams was a wildcatter in the vein of the old-time wildcatters. He made the Gataga No. 2 gas strike in 1975 in Loving County near Mentone. But then the bankers and accountants got a hold of him, and he had to think about how to sustain the growth. It was hit and miss. They knew after they had drilled some wells and got core samples that there was a sedimentary basin. They didn't have the benefits of seismic information, but they used surface geology to start and got lucky in the 1950s and hit the Sprayberry field, which was pretty shallow. McDaniel said the wildcatters would hit maybe 1 in 10, but they never started a project without believing that they would make a well. The odds were stacked against them, he said. If they found a field, they developed inside it and then stepped out from where the edges of it were. In those days, a well didn't pay out very quickly. Midland and Odessa didn't have much going for them at all till the post-World War II 50s, when they started developing these oil fields and giving the GIs who stayed here jobs. The Eastern families of wealth sent their children or relatives out here to diversify their investments. They were drilling with rotary bits right after rotary bits were invented in 1933. Now they have all this information from downhole technology, guided by GPS. It took a bunch of people, including landmen, geologists, and brokers, to make it come together and work. McDaniel said other important early day figures were William M. Fuller, the ranch in Cogdell family, Fred Hogan, who built the Hogan Building in 1928 and provided much-needed office space where the Yucca Theater is now in downtown Midland, and Clarence Scarborough, who built the Scarborough Hotel in 28, where lots of oil and cow deals were made. Then Jack Wilkinson Sr. built numerous high-rise buildings to give those oil companies office space, he said. The key elements that were needed to make it work were office space, transportation, and money. Oil is a commodity subject to the vagaries of the markets, but the Wildcatters were not afraid to take risks, and they were smart enough to do their homework and make a go of it. It took a special kind of personality to see the opportunities and then decide to step out and take their risks, seize those opportunities. After the 1983 failure of Midland's First National Bank, in the midst of the worst oilfield slump that the basin ever had, McDaniel said, most of the major oil companies fled in 1986 when oil prices fell below $10 a barrel. A lot of people thought that was the end of this part of the world, but all it did was open up opportunities for independent producers like Joe Parsley and his partner Howard Parker, he said, adding that Parker and Parsley Petroleum merged with Mesa Inc. in 1997 to form Pioneer Natural Resources. In the early years of oil exploration, there developed a codependent relationship between the rancher and the oil man. The rancher held the key to the development of the minerals underneath his surface, and the oil man held the key to wealth produced by the development of those minerals. At times, there were strained relationships between the two, but in the end, they all benefited. Shannon, executive director of the Permian Basin Petroleum Museum, said Sid Richardson, Mac Chase, the John E. Mabee family, and the Martin Yates family in eastern New Mexico also figure heavily into the story. They had a never-give-up attitude, Shannon said. They kept trimming and drew something out of nothing. The early geologists thought the land had reserves of oil. It was hard to find it, but they did after O.C. Harper's maps gave them a better idea of where to drill. Sid Richardson didn't know how many dry holes he drilled before he hit his first well. Shannon said the beginning of the basin as a worldwide oil and gas hub was investor Frank Pickrell's and driller Carl Cromwell's 1922 initiative near Big Lake in Reagan County to form the Texine Oil and Land Company, and spend 646 days drilling the Santa Rita No. 1 well, named for the Saint of Impossible Causes, and making only 4.7 feet of daily progress, finally to hit dolomitic lands and bring up natural gas bubbles before the oil came blowing out from 3,050 feet. The early oil wells were very shallow, and when they first learned how to drill to 10,000 and 12,000 feet, the basin became a natural gas field, not so much oil, she said. The Santa Rita set it in motion and helped establish it as an oil field. Fracturing shale brought it back to oil, which they had known was there, they just couldn't get it out. Shannon said another crucial development was the construction by 1950 of 15,000 miles of pipelines to move the oil and gas to markets on the Gulf Coast. George Mitchell figured out how to frack, and the Jim Henry Group perfected it with slick or soapy water in the early 2000s, she said. Don't miss it. Starbright Village opens Friday. Light show will run through January 2nd. Having seen a record 268,000 visitors last year, Odessa's famously extravagant Starbright Village Christmas light show will open Friday and run through January 2nd with a big new animated fireworks display. Mayor Javier Hoven will light the village at 6:30 p.m. Thursday after performances by local choirs and dance groups, and an appearance by Santa Claus in McKinney Park at 625 North Pool Road, adjacent to Interstate 20. The Chuck Wagon Gang will serve free hot chocolate, and food trucks will offer meals. City Parks and Recreation Director Steve Patton said the animated fireworks display will be 40 feet wide and 50 feet tall and situated in the middle of Starbright Village, which will sport a total of over 300,000 lights. It's an incredible display, Patton said, adding that only walkthroughs will be allowed on the first night. The hours will be basically from 7 to 11 p.m., but we'll turn the lights on earlier if it gets dark, and we will keep them on after 11 if there is a super crowd, he said. We won't turn them off in the middle of a crowd. Along with people from throughout the Permian Basin, he said, numerous visitors come off I-20 to drive or walk through the village and see the 80-plus lighted displays as Christmas music plays. I have talked to people from Alaska and Canada, he said. They come from all over. The 268,000 was just those who drove through. Patton said Starbright Village evolved from a 50-foot-tall Christmas tree that went up for the first time in a community tree lighting ceremony 34 years ago at City Hall. The idea caught on, and the first village was created in McKinney Park in the early 1990s. It's the biggest light show between Dallas and El Paso. Admission is free.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.